Let me pray and we'll get started. Father, we just are grateful to you this morning for this time. This is a very interesting portion of history. A lot of good things going on and some things that we are not as excited about. But you're constantly working in history in that way. You're bringing about your purposes. Ultimately, it all works for your glory. And yet we see things that are good. We see things that are bad on the surface. And we are trying to evaluate. We're trying to assess. And some of the things we look at this morning help us evaluate our own country and how it came into being. And we want to understand that from your perspective. So help us to understand these things that we study today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right. We are picking up from last week. We began looking at the Enlightenment, the period, the Age of Reason is sometimes called. And this is what a major shift in the thinking of the intellectual community of the world took place, and it created the kind of secular world that we have today. It was really the groundwork for our current secular environment. And so it really gives us some insight into how we went from this world that was Christianized, you know, and it was just a matter of battling over whether the Lutherans or the Catholics or the Reformed people were right, you know, and having 30-year wars and everything, to completely throwing off all of that and becoming more of a secular society. And that's what we saw last week. And there's a lot in that that we regret as Christians looking back historically. But then there's a lot that we are on board with, and there was a lot of blessing in that at the same time. So it was a kind of a mix going on. And I mentioned last time in particular that many people, the first step was everybody, the largely, again, secular community or intellectual community, they didn't immediately become atheist. They became deist. They still considered the existence of God to be a no-brainer. You know, like, there's got to be a God. But they rewrote who God was and turned him into the watchmaker God. Remember we talked about last week, where it's just like he wound up the clock and turned it loose, and he doesn't interfere with his creation. No resurrections here, no miracles here. Just a world that runs all by itself like a great big giant clock. They begin to discover that the solar system is like a big clock. Everything runs by these very consistent laws, and they were discovering them. They were excited about that. And, of course, it's beneficial to us that they did discover those things. The scientific method is very useful. And yet, at the same time, they began to feel like there was no need for God. We understand the universe. We can figure everything out by our own reasoning. We're smart enough now. We realize we're smart enough. We don't need God. We don't need revelation. So that was the downside of it. So that's kind of where we left off. And I have one little piece I wanted to add to that before we move into our next portion of we're going to cover on the Enlightenment, which is that the Christians did give a response at that time, though some did not do so well at that. So we're going to look at that first. And Joseph Butler, a name that I was not familiar with until I came across this, is one of those who gave a good response. So I want to look at that to start off with. And then we're going to get into, last week we looked at the Enlightenment in science, mostly science. There was a sort of political wing to the Enlightenment where political ideas were developed. And that's a whole different cup of tea, though you're going to see a lot of the same elements in it. So we'll get to that in just a minute, just to give you a heads up on where we're going. But let's finish this up. This has to do with the science primarily. So Enlightenment intellectuals were thoroughly aware they were fomenting a revolution in the fundamental beliefs of Europeans. This was turning the world upside down, and they knew it. They knew it, and many of them celebrated it. Voltaire, in particular, reported on each new triumph of reason over the church with the exaltation of a commander winning battles. He recognized it for what it was. It was a battle. And they were winning the battle. And he was excited about that. And remember, we pointed out there were many in the Enlightenment who held on to their Christianity, at least in some form, and tried to reconcile the two as best they could as they were encountering new ideas that couldn't be denied. You know, it couldn't be denied that the planets of the solar system revolve around the sun, not the earth. You know, there were changes taking place that had to be made. And But at the same time, they were trying to figure this out. Others, like Voltaire, were happy to throw off the religious trappings altogether. These attacks upon Christian convictions demanded a vigorous and well-reasoned response from Orthodox Christians. As Christians, and this has been true all the way, you go all the way back to the early church. Remember, what did the Christians do? How did Christians fight? They don't typically grab the, well, for a while they were grabbing the sword and the horse. But Christians, their real battle is not against flesh and blood, against principalities and powers, through making arguments. A response is needed. If something like this moves into a society, Christians need to counter. Unfortunately, in Catholic countries like France, the reaction was woefully inadequate. So for all the Catholics' work in countering the Reformation, you know, the Jesuits, we talked about all that, they didn't do too good fighting against the secular movement that was coming into society. And you'll see today the Catholic Church is totally sold out where it comes to the secular science, right? Evolution, all that. Oh, totally fine with that. Church leaders were not indifferent to the rising tide of infidelity, but they tried to check it by traditional means. What was that? Well, they appealed to secular authority to censor dangerous books, but they were usually unfamiliar with the primary issues the scoffers raised. So they saw that it was a danger at that point. Like I said, today, the Catholic Church is, the best I can tell, totally capitulated to the secularist. But at this point in time, they saw the danger and realized it was something that should be fought back against. But when they went to fight back, they went back to their old playbook, which is censor, torture, kill. And that wasn't working. It doesn't work. Because they didn't even understand the arguments of what their opponents were coming up with. They didn't bother to understand their opponents. That's terrible. If you're going to respond to somebody, you must first understand what they're saying. And they didn't bother. That was in France. That was the Catholics. In England, however, it was different. Several men wrote effectively against deism, and according to this history book, none was more so effective than Bishop Joseph Butler, and that's the guy that we're looking at now. His monumental work, The Analogy of Religion, virtually ended the debate for thinking people. He was that effective. Who knew? Right? Skirmishes continued for years, but after Butler, it was clear the fundamental issues had been settled. So he took deism and knocked it on its behind, and they didn't know what hit them. The deists were confident, with their confident optimism, assumed they knew all about God's wisdom and purpose. They read it all in the pattern of nature. So their whole approach was, you know, we don't need the Bible. We can just look at nature and understand who God is and how God thinks about things. We can read the wisdom of God just looking at the way the stars move and the molecules move and all the things that they were familiar with. Butler, however, saw with disarming clarity that life is filled with perplexities and enigmas. Not so fast there, Pilgrim, he says. Butler did not try to prove the existence of God. Deists never denied this premise. Nor did Butler reject reason. He accepted it as man's natural light. So here's something that a good debater does. He understands his opponent, and he doesn't go after a straw dog. You know what a straw dog is? You know, a lot of times if you're arguing with somebody, if you make up some argument that sounds like his argument, that's real easy for you to tear apart, and you tear it apart, he's going to go, that's not my argument. You don't even understand what I'm saying. He understood them. He's not going to, why would you try to prove the existence of God to a deist? They believe in God. That wasn't the problem. Why would you go after reason and say reason is, no, reason's a good thing. He's not going to argue that. That wasn't where he went with this. So he understood his opponents. He understood what was good about them. It's great that they believe in God and great they believe in reason. But where was the problem? He did challenge reason's sovereignty. Reason, said Butler, provides no complete system of knowledge. And in ordinary life, it can offer us only probabilities. He said, reason isn't all you think it is. You think you understand the whole world because you have reason. Reason doesn't give you much. It gives you something. It gives you something. Probabilities. Maybe this is the case. Probably this is the case. The Occam's razor business and all that. Thus, Butler undermined deism's fortress, its confidence in reason. That was what they built their whole house of cards on, was hey, reason can solve anything. He says, really? You think reason can give you answers to everything? Why can't you explain all this stuff that's going on? There's all kind of stuff you can't explain. Yeah, that's true. Nature, he said, is not a realm in which reason is supreme. Not to say it's not helpful. It just doesn't solve all the problems. Nature's filled with obscurities, unexplained mysteries, even to this day, right? There are things we can't explain. All the science and instruments that we have and the computers, and we still can't explain everything. We meet perplexity at every turn. How does reason save you? How does reason give you the ultimate answer? It doesn't. And if we meet problems in nature, should we be surprised if we encounter difficulties in religion? I think the people who were touting reason said, you know, you guys in the religious sphere, you got all kind of problems you can't explain. Huh, you got all kind of problems you can't explain, right? In the end, deism collapsed from its own weaknesses. It was based on false optimism. It had no explanation for the evils and disasters of life. How can reason explain the fall? See, Christianity's got a beautiful answer for the fall. We know why the world's a mess, right? We expect the world to be a mess based on our creation story. They don't have an answer to something like it. Why is it that way? Because the laws of nature were clear and unalterable, deists assumed that man's moral choices drawn from nature were simple and unchanging. But that's not true. If asked, why don't men always see clearly the religious truths in nature? If man's so reasonable, and you have such great answers, why is it everybody can't see it? And all they could say, well, it's because of the lies of the religious leaders. They're confusing everybody. But really, that didn't wash. Too simplistic. And few were really convinced by that argument. That just didn't hold. Unfortunately, here's the sad thing. So Butler did a great job responding. That needed to happen. And he apparently it did happen. But here's the bad thing. The eventual rejection of deism, and it did happen, people rejected deism, did not restore Christianity to the central place in Western culture. We'd lost something. Christianity was in the center of culture before the Enlightenment moved in. And now they're battling against the Enlightenment, but in bringing down the edifice of Enlightenment, they didn't get to re-erect the Christian role in culture that was once there. It's like something had been lost. And we see that today, right? The negative work of the Age of Reason endured. Almost all formal Christian influence was lost in modern culture. Its art, its education, its politics. And isn't that still true today, really? I mean, not to say Christians can't have influence here and there and so forth, but largely speaking, Christians aren't the main voice in culture anymore. They're just not. And that started here. In its place, men have made a deliberate attempt to organize a religiously neutral civilization. So instead of going back to Christianity, they said, well, it's just all neutral. We're not going to have any right and wrong or foundation. But you always have something. There is no such thing as neutral. You know, the scriptures teach that. You know, you're either for me or you're against me. There's no neutral here. But they create this picture of, well, we're just going to be neutral. We're not really holding to anything. Yes, you are. Yes, you are holding to something. You are very, very much so holding to something. You're rejecting something over here, at least. There's no neutral, but that's how they convinced themselves that they're this voice of reason. And so what does that result in? Well, this meant that faith now had to function in the private realms, confined to church, home, and heart. And that is what we still find today in modern society, is it not? You can have your religion in your own home, in your own heart, in your own church, but don't get it in the public square. Mm-mm-mm-mm. Nope, 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 nope. We don't want to hear from you. You can just shut up now. That's where things had moved, and they're still there. In fact, there's an we're feeling this really being pushed on now today. This leaves Christians with a basic problem in the modern era. How far can believers go in trying as citizens to get the state to enforce standards of Christian conduct when they don't believe those standards? Or, if Christians give up the idea of enforcing Christian behavior because they feel like, well, they just have to be kept private and they're not going to listen to me, then what norm of conduct should they, as citizens, try to make an obligation for everyone. What should we be trying to advocate? Of course, we've raised this question many times in this class, right, as we've been looking at the church and state arguments and things like that. And this is a beautiful segue into our next segment. So it's the way the history book closed out the section on Burke and his response, and it opened up the door for the thing that I wanted to cover next, which is I want to look now at the Enlightenment influence on politics. We've looked at the influence on science, the discovery of things in the universe and all that kind of stuff. The Enlightenment also made much progress and made many developments, and some of it may be negative progress, in the area of politics. So that's what we're now going to look at. The Enlightenment has long been hailed as the foundation of modern Western political and intellectual culture. And I think when we get done today, you're going to see that's very much a true statement. The era is marked by three political revolutions, which together lay the basis for modern republican constitutional democracies. We have the English Revolution of 1688. We almost got there when I covered the history of England and we talked about the Puritans and then how it went back to a monarchy. There was one more revolution that took place that wasn't as significant, where the Parliament had the king again came back, and then he got too heavy-handed, he overplayed his hand, and so the Parliament rose up and permanently locked down the king. He said, you know, we're not going to get rid of the king, but you don't have the power that you once had. And so Parliament rose up, and that was in 1688. That was significant, as we will see later. Not today, probably next week. There's the American Revolution, of course, we're all familiar with that. And then there's the French Revolution, which is just a bit later than the American Revolution. And the nature of those two revolutions, I'm going to argue next week, are very different, as different as night and day. But we'll look at all that, because there are things they had in common, that's the thing. And even to people in the day, it was confusing. For the Americans, was the French Revolution good? Is it not good? Yeah, you know. So we'll look at all that later, but just laying the groundwork here. Some of the major political changes resulted in these big revolutions that have changed the world. Enlightenment philosophers believed that the existing political and social authorities of their day were shrouded in religious myth and mystery founded on obscure traditions, and they sought through Enlightenment-style reasoning to rethink them. Well, that's not... You see how this looks just like what they did in science, right? They're going to use reason to go back over some of the thinking about government and about politics and rethink it, because they don't think it's been handled right. And your first reaction to that is, oh no, here we go again, right? But was it all bad? Was it all bad? Check this out. Many of the ideals of modern Western governments were developed and articulated during the Enlightenment period. Listen to this list, it's a short list. The idea that governments derive their just powers by the consent of the governed. What's that a quote of? Anybody know? Every American should know, this is a major American document. Who says that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed? Not the Constitution, it's the other one. Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. One of the assertions he made, along with, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, those kinds of ideas. This is one of the founding ideas of the American experiment, some people call it. Is that a good idea? Do governments derive their just powers by the consent of the governed? Our country has operated from that premises from the beginning. The articulation of political ideals of freedom and equality. Now, honestly, we're seeing the overplaying of this today. We might want to draw back and say, I'm not sure that is a good idea. But you think back prior to the Enlightenment period, the idea of freedom and equality, that was not a thing. Is that a good thing, that we have freedom and equality? Within reason, obviously. The articulation of a list of basic individual human rights to be respected and realized by any legitimate political system. It's just basic rights that people have. You don't go beyond those. Is that a good idea? Yeah, there wasn't this kind of limit really prior to the Enlightenment period, generally speaking. Here's one, surely we sign off on, the articulation and promotion of religious liberty as a virtue to be respected in a well-ordered society. That was not a thing before the Enlightenment. Do we value this? We really value it now, because if we don't have it, we're fixing to get some big trouble, right? Hey, what happened to religious liberty? Hello? That is an Enlightenment value. Remember, we've been talking about that. Luther would never believe in that. The Catholics never believe in that. Calvin didn't believe in that, religious liberty. Is that a good value? That's an Enlightenment political value. Our country's built on it. It's one of the founding principles. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion. First two amendments. The concept that political power should be organized in a system of checks and balances. You know, we have the three branches of government, and they all keep a check. You know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You've heard this expression. And so we need checks and balances to keep anything that becomes too powerful because of sin will just become a monster. We can't have that. We must have checks and balances. Is that a good thing? That's an Enlightenment principle. That's an Enlightenment principle. The political ideals of the Enlightenment were informed and guided to a significant extent by the political philosophers of that period. And so we're going to take a look at two of them. There were many, many more than two, I promise you. And we're going to look at the English philosophers, two of the English philosophers. I think they were the ones that made the best arguments. And even these two guys we look at, we're only going to look at a sliver of what they presented in some of their books and writings and so forth. I just want to give us a taste, and I think what we look at today will give us that. Time doesn't permit us to explore this to the degree that I and my insane curiosity would love to explore. And actually, I did explore on my own already, and that's why I chose the things to show you that idea, just to kind of give you a taste, if you will. And I'll tell you going into this, I'm not holding these guys up as all-knowing or saints or guys who got it all right. But you're going to hear their arguments, and you're going to recognize, hey, that's some of the foundational thinking that we just talked about here, that came from them. And we're going to show you how they reasoned through some of the things that they did and give you a chance to evaluate. What do you think about the way they reasoned through some of the stuff? So we're going to start looking at Thomas Hobbes. By the way, I just have to ask this. How many of you are familiar with the comic, the old comic strip, Calvin and Hobbes? A lot of you. It's my favorite comic of all time. I hate that Bill Watterson quit writing it, you know, back in the 90s or whatever it was. Guess who Hobbes was named after? Guess who Calvin was named after? Yeah, they were named after the historic. He was a history major, and he was a political commentator for a while. I don't know if he's a major, but he was studied in history, and he was familiar with it, so he named it after Thomas Hobbes. Anyways, Thomas Hobbes, he's one of the classical sources of Enlightenment political theory, 1588 to 1679, so he's pretty early. He wrote a work which he named Leviathan. You know what Leviathan is? It's in the Bible, actually, the King James Version, I think. Sea monster, gigantic sea monster. He wrote a book called Leviathan that argues for the necessity of a powerful, sovereign, governing authority. The metaphor for that powerful, sovereign, governing authority was a sea monster, this giant behemoth, if you will. And he was arguing that that was the way to go. Big government, big government. Hobbes argues for this by imagining men in their natural state, what he calls the state of nature. Now, we need to follow his argument here, so to try to track with this as best you can. When he talks about a state of nature, he's picturing man in an environment pre-government, if you will. And you say, well, there is no such place. Well, think about, like, if a desert island emerges out of the sea, and nobody claims, I don't know how this works, but, you know, let's say some people move there, various people move there, and there's no government, there's nobody that really owns it, you're just kind of there on your own, and you're seeing people interacting with them. That would be an example of a state of nature. Now, it's pre-government setting the rules for everything. And we don't think in that realm very much. I think about this a lot. I mean, everywhere we go, we know we're kind of under the cover of government, right? Nobody can just, you know, do something bad to you without having to face the consequences legally, right? And you always have that protection in the back of your mind. What if you're in a situation, anybody ever heard of the book Lord of the Flies, I think it's called? It's a bunch of teenage boys that were on a desert, marooned on a desert island or whatever, and it just shows what crazy stuff takes place when there's no existing government in place. That's what we're talking about. We talk about state of nature. He starts with this kind of basic idea of state of nature. It's sort of a thought experiment, okay? In the state of nature, which is a purely hypothetical, according to Hobbes, although, like I said, it has occurred at times, men are naturally and exclusively self-interested. They are more or less equal to one another. Even the strongest man can be killed in his sleep. There are limited resources, and yet there's no power able to force men to cooperate. If somebody wants to try to, steal what you got or kill you or make you a slave, there's nothing really to stop them, other than if you're powerful enough to fight them back. Given these conditions, in the state of nature, Hobbes concludes that the state of nature would be unbearably brutal, that the life of man in the state of nature would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, is a famous quote from Hobbes of what he thinks life would be like if we didn't have government. And if you look at a book like Lord of Flies, you kind of go, yeah, that's kind of what it is like. In the state of nature, every person is always in fear of losing his life to another. No long-term or complex cooperation is possible because the state of nature can be aptly described as a state of utter distrust. You see this kind of thing arise. Have you ever seen one of these movies where there's a shipwreck? Gilligan's Island or something like that. That's kind of a comedy, but or a plane wreck or something, and all the people on the ship or all the people on the plane are suddenly marooned. There's no government in place to make everything work. People are just kind of, suddenly this distrust can arise. People can start doing things to you. Hey, who's making the laws here? You hope maybe when we get rescued, we can make you pay, if you don't behave yourself. But really, it's scary, right? It's scary. That's what he's arguing. He's saying that's like the worst state ever. Given Hobbes' reasonable assumption that most people want first and foremost to avoid their own deaths, that's a pretty reasonable assumption, he concludes that the state of nature is the worst possible situation in which men can find themselves. That's his argument. It is the state of perpetual and unavoidable war, as he sees it. The situation, however, is not hopeless. Being reasonable, men can be expected to construct a social contract. This is the key buzzword of this era. The idea of a social contract where men get together and make an agreement amongst themselves. They can construct a social contract that will afford them a life other than that available in the state of nature, which is just chaos. They can say, hey, we're going to have rules, we're going to have somebody in charge, and we're not going to have this concern about the distrust or the strong dominating the weak kind of idea. First, they must agree to establish society by collectively and reciprocally renouncing the rights they had against one another in the state of nature. You're going to have to give up a lot of your rights. You're going to have to concede that whatever society comes up with, you're going to abide by those rules. You can't just go out and do what you want like you did before. Second, they must imbue some one person or assembly of persons with the authority and power to enforce the initial contract. If you don't have teeth in the contract, it's no good. You can make rules. If somebody's going to be forced to obey it by some powerful government, what good did it do? Nothing. Right? In other words, to ensure their escape from the state of nature, they must both agree to live together under common laws and create an enforcement mechanism for the social contract and the laws that constitute it. That makes sense, right? And since the sovereign is invested with the authority and power to mete out punishments for breaches of the contract, which are worse than not being able to act as one pleases, men have good, albeit self-interested, reason to treat others fairly. So it's not as ideal as getting to do what you want to before there was no government, but it's better than the chaotic situation you'd face if you didn't have government, because at least everybody's being forced to treat everybody fairly, so the theory goes. Society becomes possible because now there's a more powerful person who can force men to cooperate. And while living under the authority of a sovereign can be harsh, it's at least better than living under the state of nature. So there are times when living under authority, a government is bad, but it's better than the state of nature. And so Hobbes argues, now here's the key to his argument, and we're going to contest this in a minute with our next figure that we look at, which is John Locke. Hobbes argues that no matter how poorly a sovereign manages the affairs of a state and regulates our own lives, we are never justified in resisting this power because, not because God commands it or something like that. He's not operating from a biblical framework here. He's operating from reason. We're never justified in rebelling against this governing authority because it's the only thing which stands between us and what we most want to avoid, the state of nature. So to him, the state of nature is the worst thing ever, and any government, no matter how terrible, is better than that. I don't think he'd been to North Korea, but I'm just saying. That's what he thought. Okay, so John Locke is the second guy, the only other guy we're going to look at. And he's going to be arguing along a similar line, but he splits with Hobbes at one point, and that's a critical point. So the works of Locke are another one of the classical sources of Enlightenment political theory. And he came up with a lot of theory, by the way. He was a philosopher and a lot of other things. We're just looking at one aspect of his thinking. Like Hobbes, Locke began reasoning about the need for governments by examining how man might function in the state of nature. Again, that same term. They were used to using these terms. These were buzzwords of the day. Unlike Hobbes, Locke sees the state of nature as a state of perfect liberty where one can conduct his life as he best sees fit, free from the interference of others. I don't think it's a horrible place to be. I think it'd be great to not have to worry about governments if we could do it. The state of nature, although a state where there is no civil authority or government to punish people for transgressions against law, it's not a state without morality, he argues. Remember, he's the guy we looked at last week where he had some commitment to Christian principles. I don't know if he was a Christian, fully speaking, and he certainly had his view of God was a skewed view from Scripture. But nevertheless, he tries to tie back into biblical ideas. And here's one example where he does it. He talks about the law of nature. When you hear law of nature, think of Romans 2, the law of a conscience that God puts in the heart of every man. That's the idea I think he's getting at here, what he calls the law of nature. Again, this was a buzzword of the day, which was they recognized that people in general recognized that there was a moral law that we all were sort of under because of God. That's the idea. The law of nature, which in Locke's view is the basis for all morality and given to us by God, according to Locke, commands that we not harm others with regards to their life, health, liberty, or possessions. This is like love your neighbor as yourself, basically. And he said, we're all under the moral law, and so in a state of nature, if we all abide by the moral law, life is good. That's a big if. So in a perfect world, because of the law of nature and the restrictions it imposes upon people, the state of nature where people are free to pursue their own interests, plans, free from interference, should theoretically result in a relatively peaceful existence. Theoretically would be the key word there. Unfortunately, the state of nature can, and in the real world, will devolve into what he calls the state of war. Even he recognizes this. The state of war begins between two or more men, once one man declares war on another by stealing from him or trying to make him a slave. So all well and good as long as everybody follows the moral law, but as soon as somebody goes, wait a minute, I'm not following no moral law. I'm going to make you my slave. Or I'm going to take what you got here. And you can't take that. Now we're at war. Since in the state of nature there is no civil power to whom men can appeal, right? By definition, we're saying there's no government. And since the law of nature allows them to defend their own lives, they may rightfully kill those who would bring force against them. So he's saying one of the moral laws is you have a right to defend yourself. You can agree or disagree with that. That's what he believes. And I think people generally kind of believe that. Although I understand the arguments about turning the other cheek. We could go down that road. I'm not going there. Just generally speaking here. Since the state of nature lacks civil authority, once war begins, it's likely to continue. Remember, like the old Hatfields and McCoys, you know, one group kills the other, and then the other gets mad, and they retaliate, and then the other group, they get. And he said, there's no end to that. Once that starts, it doesn't end. And this is one of the strongest reasons men have to abandon the state of nature by contracting to form civil government. So he gets to the same place as Hobbes, in a sense. Got to have civil government. That's why. Civil government comes into being when an individual man representing their families, notice how he framed that. He sees decisions being made by the heads of households. He views mankind as divided up into households. It's subtle. It just slipped in there, but I just point that out. It comes into being when individual men representing their families come together in the state of nature and agree to give up the exercise of power to punish those who transgress the law of nature and hand over that power to a public power of government. So same thing as Hobbes came up with. You're giving up some of your rights, you're giving up some of your power to this government so that you can have a greater peace and no war. Having done this, they then become subject to the will of the majority. In other words, by making a compact to leave the state of nature and form society, they make a civil government and submit themselves to the will of that society and that civil government. So they're going to make an agreement, and in doing so, they're giving up certain power, but they're getting certain things in return. That's the agreement they make. One joins such a society either from its beginnings, now as you're in the original deal, the ground floor, or after it's already been established by others, there's a government in place, and you want to become a part of that government. You do so only by explicit consent. This is not something that just automatically happens in his mind. It's something a person has to agree to. Having created a political society and government through their consent, men then gain three things which they lack in the state of nature. Here's the three things you get when you form a government. You get laws that everybody agrees to. You get judges to adjudicate the law and make sure that people are obeying the laws, or judge whether they're obeying or not. And you get the executive power necessary to enforce those laws. Again, no teeth, the law is worthless. Does that look familiar? Laws, judges, executive. Oh, that's the three branches of government. How about that? Each man, therefore, gives over the power to protect himself and punish transgressors of the law of nature to the government that he's created through the compact. It's created through a compact. Remember the Pilgrims when they came, they had the Mayflower Compact where they agreed to certain rules. This is how people thought. And see, again, they were kind of in a state of nature. They're coming over on a boat to a deserted land. You got to come up with something, right? Now, England's a long way away. You're not going to be able to take them to court back in England very easily, right? Given that the purpose in forming a civil government is the preservation of their wealth, preserving their lives, liberty, and well-being in general, that was the reason why you made a government, right? Locke argues that there are conditions. Now, here's where he splits company with Hobbes. There are conditions under which the compact with government might be destroyed and men would be justified in resisting the authority of civil government, such as a king. He said the whole reason we made government was to protect our life, liberty, and property. If a government doesn't do that anymore, then they're not doing what we contracted with them to do. So when the executive power of government devolves into tyranny by like dissolving the legislature, for example, making it so that people can't make laws anymore, when the resultant tyrant puts himself in a state of war with the people and they have the same right of self-defense they had before making the compact to establish society in the first place. So he says if the government violates that agreement, guess what? The moral law, as he sees it, includes self-defense. I can defend myself against the government just like I can against the other people who were attacking me before there was a government. That's where he differs from Hobbes, right there. He splits. And do you recognize this is the foundation of our American government? In other words, justification of the authority of the executive component of government is protection of people's property, well-being. So when the protection is no longer present, or when the king becomes a tyrant and acts against the interests of the people have a right, catch this, if not outright obligation, to resist his authority. It's the right thing to do, to resist the authority of a tyrant, because that government is no longer functioning in the role that it was given by the agreement, by the compact. Under these circumstances, the social compact can be dissolved and the process to create political society begins anew. Start all over again, back to the drawing board. That's where you go. I went through that really fast, but I hope you followed that. This is profound. I mean, this is what our government was founded on, these ideals. These ways of thinking about things. And this was new. This was not the way things used to be. So next time, we are going to look at a comparison of the American and French revolutions. I think you all will want to be here for this because we're going to really hit some really interesting things. Notice the picture. What do we have there? These are the two emblems of the two revolutions. What's the emblem of the American Revolution? The Liberty Bell. What's the emblem of the French Revolution? The guillotine. That right there tells the whole story, actually. So we're going to look at the difference between those two. We're going to look at the rational foundation for the American Revolution. How many of you have felt like, and maybe you still will after the next class, I don't know that you won't, that the American Revolution, you know, glad it happened, but, you know, if I'd been here, I probably would have been on the side of England because I think they kind of rebelled against authority. I think they were kind of they were kind of wrong, right? I can make an argument against that and see what you think about next week. So come back. That's a tease for you. I'm saying I'm right. And it's not going to be my argument, by the way. I'm going to go back and get their argument. Because, see, a lot of people don't realize what the American Revolution was founded upon. They have this picture in their head because they're ignorant of history, and they don't realize what all the issues were. And if you go back and look at what the issues were in the day, I'm going to actually quote from people in that day and show you what they were thinking. It's not what you think. I think most of you would be surprised. Okay. Well, with that, my questions are not coming up in the right order, so I'm going to just get them all up there. Here are our discussion questions. How good a job are Christians doing in responding to and refuting secularists in our day? In what way should we be doing better? Remember, you know, the French didn't do a very good job. The English did. How far can believers go in trying as citizens to get the state to enforce Christian standards of conduct? Or if Christians give up the idea of enforcing Christian behavior, then what norm of conduct should they as citizens try to make an obligation for everyone? Or maybe you say, I don't think we should even be in the business. Some of you will probably say that, but just a thought. If you care, what do you care to do? Next question, what do you think of the Enlightenment idea that governing authorities derive their just powers by the consent of the governed? That's a founding principle of our country. Do you believe it? And last, Hobbes argues that no matter how poorly a sovereign manages the affairs of the state and regulates our own lives, we are never justified in resisting his power because it is the only thing which stands between us and what we most want to avoid, the state of nature. Locke, on the other hand, argues there are conditions under which the compact with government might be destroyed and men would be justified in resisting the authority of a civil government. Who got it right, and why do you think that? That's a million-dollar mouthful question. But there you go. A lot of ground here. I almost want to have another whole class to discuss these questions. Maybe we will at the end of the second class, because next week we're going to raise very similar questions, but it's going to be applied to the revolutions. We're going to see what the French did with these questions. We're going to see what the Americans did with it. Big difference.
I'll take that big one first.
The last one, Hobbes? Okay.
I don't fully agree with either one of them, and I don't really agree with using terms like never and always. It's just, I will almost always disagree with anyone if that's part of the phrasing.
Like you just did, always. Yeah.
So, the key to both of those to me is the word resist. I don't think there's anything wrong with resisting, and there are times when I think we should resist. The extreme to which that is taken, either on the never side or the destroy it side, are both extremes I don't think that we can go to as Christians. So if the government is, you know, take Daniel for example, you can't pray anymore, or you have to go worship this idol, we have an obligation to resist that. So if we're told to do something that is in violation of something God's told us to do, we have the obligation to resist.
Sure.
Does that mean that we should start a revolution and pick up weapons and go destroy the government? No, I don't think we're given that authority. but I do think resistance is appropriate. That's where I would leave that one.
Yeah, okay. I gotta assume that, like a lot of Christians, you'd be operating under what you see as the principle in Romans 13. God established governing authorities, and you know, we're to obey the governing authorities.
Right, which to me answers the one about governing authorities deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. So biblically speaking, I would say that's not true. Do I like that idea? Yeah. But that's because, you know, as a man, I don't like the idea of someone having power over me unless I allow them to have it. It's not real, but that's what I would like.
Well, and it could be a both and. For example, D.A. Carson uses the illustration. He said his son asked him, why are my eyes blue? And he said he could go into the algorithm, you know, between the, you know, color of your mom's eye, the color of mine, and the genetics and all that kind of stuff. And that would explain why his son's eyes were blue. It would be a true thing. Or he said he could just tell his son because God made him blue. And so Romans 13 could be explaining from the God's eye view why God ordained governments. But this could be an explanation of how some governments, certainly ours, came to be, was through a compact or agreement.
Oh, no. I agree that that's how ours came to be. But it says derive their just powers. So again, based on the words used, just powers, if they have them, to me is God-given if they are governing. Now, if you phrase that a little differently, would I say that they have the power given to them by the governed? Would I agree with that too? Yeah. At least in our country. But if you go to China or the Soviet Union, back when it was the Soviet Union, that would not be the case.
So all this was taking place with Hobbes and Locke simultaneously? Or are they both kind of in the same window?
They're contemporaries, but okay. Hobbes preceded Locke.
And they both affected the thinkers of our founding fathers.
Very much so.
Locke especially.
Yeah, I can see that. Thomas Jefferson was all over this stuff. Benjamin Franklin was all over this stuff. They were well read. They didn't just make up the American experiment out of their head. They were well grounded in a lot of historical things. They went all the way back to the Greeks and Romans and look how governments work and all that sort of thing. So what we're seeing here is exciting to me is to notice that, you know, this is where our government came from, and it wasn't, these kind of principles were not in vogue prior to the 30 Years' War.
Yeah. Does this have anything to do with what happened on January 6th in our government?
Where the people went to the Capitol and were protesting about...
Yeah, we call them insurgents, and these are American citizens, and yet we're punishing them more than a regular criminal. You know...
Some people could see that. I certainly could see where that could be.
I mean, I understand it was what they did was not right, but at the same time, these were American citizens. They weren't like foreign
invaders. Yeah.
And yet, we're treating them through the courts as if they were, and giving them the same punishments.
Well, many of the people. I mean, in that instance, and before that, I go back to the. I don't know how many remember the Tea Party. You know, I was a big fan of the Tea Party. We the people. You know, and they take that opening phrase of the Constitution and so forth. Again, going back to our founding principles, maybe if you had a monarchy, you could say, that's not the way it's been, buddy, so suck it up. But certainly with our country, it was founded on certain premises, and if it goes away from those premises, does it really have any legitimacy? That's the question being asked.
Well, I don't think it's legitimate to put a fencer on the Capitol building to keep people out. I mean,
yeah, I've not been happy about
building,
that either, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
That's a real specific, but yeah, that's what makes this. This is not just theoretical. This is really, and we're gonna be wrestling with these ideas, and that doesn't mean we're all gonna agree. We're all gonna come off in the same direction. Romans 13 plays large in the situation. I would love to go through. Maybe I'll do it. Go through Romans 13. I think Romans 13 uses a ball bat to smash Christians' heads in. And make them do whatever the government says. And I don't think it was really reads that way if you read it carefully. I think it's defining what God ordained as good government. He's not addressing evil government. Somebody once asked me, I was explaining, because I held the Romans 13 view that, you know, whatever the government does, just does. He said, so if a bunch of thugs get together and they manage to overpower the United States military and they take over and say, we're the new government, then we have to obey them? That's what you're telling me? They're the new legitimate government, huh? I'm like, well, yeah. He said, oh, that sounds great. is there a such thing as a legitimate government that really does the things that Romans 13 talked about, punishes evildoers? What if you have a government that punishes not evildoers, that are rewarding evildoers and are run by evildoers? Is that the kind of government that, I don't think that's the kind of government Paul was talking about in that passage. Now, you might say, well, you still got to do it anyways. Not for you to judge. I mean that would be the argument.
That at a time the Christians were being persecuted under a Roman emperor. You don't think that he meant what he said?
What's that?
Well, you said he meant a legitimate government. So this was an empire that was built by conquest.
Sure.
And they were not friendly to Christians or Jews. And that was the context in which he wrote that. I don't think he was talking about some idealized government that might exist someday. I think he meant this is the world we live in and this is the way it is.
Right. Well, the Roman government had a lot of good and had a lot of bad. A lot of what the Roman government was good. They punished evildoers. And to that extent, Paul says...
Including Paul.
Yeah. But he says if you want to avoid being punished by the government, he says, then do what is right. and then you won't be punished. Now, is that technically true? No, if the government does evil, then it's going to actually punish you anyway, like you said, like Paul did. In that case, it stepped outside the bounds of what he's talking about. He's just saying governments have a good place, and they do good things. Even the Roman government does, even our government still does some good things. We're not totally lost. But does that mean everything the government does, we just have to consider it legitimate just because they're government? That's the question that's being asked, I would ask anyways, in regards to that. So.
I like the verse in Proverbs, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. When the wicked beareth rule, they mourn.
Yeah. Except for the other wicked, they kind of like it because then they get they get to go in the driver's seat.
This only works if it's a moral people.
Yeah, yeah, if it's a moral people, and that's one of the keys to being able to have a good government. Well, we're out of time. Next week we're going to see the outworking of this in the revolutions that took place. And again, I find it stimulating to kind of, because we need to be able to contend and work through in our own minds. How should we be responding to things that are going on out there? Like you talk about the Capitol and so forth. You know, could I have been there? You know, I didn't, but you know, could I have been? Would that have been a problem? It's good for us to think through these things. We need to be able to iron these things out, because we're going to really, this is no longer just theoretical. If you live in a nice Christian government or a nice government that pretty much treats everybody well, this doesn't become all that controversial. But you get a government like ours that's making the kind of shifts that it's making, and we're going to have some hard questions to answer. So, Father, we do pray for your wisdom, and we do not want to be guilty of distorting your word. We don't want to be guilty of just reading in what we want because we want to read it in. But we don't want to miss something or read in something that's not there just because everybody's always said it was there. We want to think through and understand what your heart is, what your mind is, what you would have us to do, what you would have us to be. Help us to evaluate not only historically but our own situation. And give us wisdom for these things. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. You're dismissed.